Rumble. And we're looking, because it's spin one half particles, that the Hamiltonian is just the Zeeman term. And replacing this magnetic field along the z-axis. And the it's often called a static magnetic field, because we've made the magnetic field to be very, very large, that typically B naught is of order of 10 Tesla, which I can only achieve in a superconducting magnet. And so the superconducting magnet is a big coil of superconducting wire. I'll show you that if you come to the lab. And the inductance of this is about 100 Henry. So it's not micro Henry as you normally see it. That's Henry. And so to change the current in this magnet is really slow. It takes days to energize a magnet. So you can, you know, calculate the time constant for that and see. So functionally, it's going to be static over our experiment. Because we have the Zeeman interaction, this leads to precession. So the spins will want to rotate about the z-axis. And they're going to rotate at a frequency omega naught is equal to 2 pi gamma b naught. Right? So they'll precess. And we saw that this ensemble, even at these high magnetic fields, for any reasonable temperature, is highly mixed, and so that the equilibrium density matrix is going to look like approximately epsilon is so small that if I think about the Boltzmann equation, I don't need to keep the whole exponent, right? That the only thing that's going to show up is this tiny variation. Okay? Yeah, you have a question. Because we have two states that are separated by an energy.
I think the Boltzmann statistics is appropriate for...
Come and see me another time.
Okay.
So that's a confusion you have. But the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution is the appropriate distribution for this. Okay? All right. So now then we have our system. We have this equilibrium density matrix, and we're going to look at the process. And we made the observation that, of course, the Zeeman interaction won't take us back to thermal equilibrium. It won't take us back to having this density matrix, okay? And so we need something else. We need to add some noise. And so we added a noise just to give us something to work with, which was a random X noise. And then we calculated, or at least it's calculated in the notes, the effective map for this. And the map would take sigma x to sigma x cosine omega naught t plus sine omega naught t with an attenuation. Similarly, sigma y would be mapped and sigma z, of course, doesn't have a rotation. It's only attenuated. And we use these times t1 and t2 because they're the convention in the field. But under this noise, t2 is equal to twice t1. Of course I did. Of course I did. Thanks. And a sigma z here. Okay, so we have this map. And the map has a piece here that says there's precession. And you can see that this particular map is depolarizing in that it takes us to the fully mixed state, right? So if I allow the system to evolve forever, then this will take us to the fully mixed state. And that's, of course, not where we want to be, but at least we're allowing for some relaxation and we can continue. Now, here there's a challenge already. And the challenge is that omega naught is of order 100 megahertz or higher. And the relaxation time, T1, is of order seconds to days. And so if I want to take this map and I want to integrate the dynamics, it's a drag. Because in order to get the precession right, then I need to have times that are of order nanoseconds, right? If I'm going to integrate this process, I better be looking at short times. And it needs to be short compared to 1 over that frequency. Okay. Yeah.
What do you mean when you say you want to get the precession right?
So if I integrate and just imagine that I take the precession as an operator, and I go ahead and integrate. So I take time and I break it into steps. That's what I mean by integrating. Let me go over this. If the time steps are too big, then I'll have the system wrapping around by too large an angle. I won't capture the correct dynamics. You must have seen that. Yes? No? Perfect. So that's what I mean here. That if I'm simply going to integrate the Schrodinger equation, then I would want to have a short time step here. You know, it would be a foolish way to do the problem. But I want to make the point that these two are widely different in time scales. That the time scale here is nanoseconds, and the time scale here is up to days, so thousands of seconds. And so I don't want to just bloody integrate this. In fact, this isn't a very useful reference frame to look at the problem in. And so what I want to do is I want to say this Hamiltonian It's so compact and simple. And we know the direction that it's about. That we can afford to go into a reference frame where we effectively remove that interaction. And by doing that, we'll make a simplified dynamics. It'll be a compact, simple set of dynamics to work with experimentally. And that's what I want to do. Okay, but before showing you why I want to go into the rotating frame, so this is going to lead us to redefining the system in the rotating frame, it's worthwhile just to sketch out what the experiment looks like. So the experiment, of course, starts with some big magnetic field. Again, this is representative of a solenoid. And we have a field B naught along the Z direction. And there's some sample in here. Remember, we have lots of spins. So let's just say that we have a sample of 10 to 17 protons. And neglect for a second how we got 10 to 17 protons. The way we're going to do the experiment is quite similar to how it was done originally. In the first experiment for this was done by Goethe. You might know that Bloch and Purcell shared the Nobel Prize for this. But the first experiment was done by Goethe. And Goethe was a Dutch physicist who was working during World War II. And during World War II, Holland was invaded, but not conscripted. And so Goethe, the universities were closed. So Goethe took his students and he said, let's just do the best physics we can with what we have. Of course, it was almost impossible to do anything. But still, so he described how to do the NMR experiment, published a beautiful paper saying all of the details of exactly how to do it, and the fact that he had failed to see a signal because he didn't have very good equipment. And after the war, Bloch and Purcell, of course, Purcell is at Harvard. Bloch was, 2 years ago he died. Purcell was at Harvard. Bloch was at Stanford. They had worked during the war at the radiation lab at MIT. And following that, they both went to their separate coasts and did the experiment. Much nicer equipment and succeeded. But it works like this. We have some synthesizer. I'm going to set it at some frequency omega t. And so out of this, I get a signal that is just cosine of omega t. Later on, we might add a phase. I'm going to take that signal, and I'm going to split it into two pieces. And then I'm going to put a gate. I'm going to switch it on and off when I like. And then I'll put a big amplifier, and I'll send it to a coil. So this coil is a resonator. They have a coil with a parallel capacitor, and so it looks like a swing. And this capacitor is just to match the impedance. It just says, I'm able to put power into that swing effectively. Here, we have a device called a directional coupler, which you probably haven't seen. But it's a very nice device. It says, if the signal is coming from this way, send it that way. If it's coming from this way, send it off to this side channel. Okay? So it's a nice little toy. I'm going to take these two signals. Remember, this one is at omega t. This one is going to be the induced EMF across that coil due to a rotating magnet. And you've seen that before. The EMF is equal to the time rate of change of the overlap or reintegrate over all space. So M here is the sum over all the microscopic magnetic moments. So we have 10 to 17 spins. It's a sum over those. So M is the bulk magnetization. So that says I have a sample with lots of spins, and I have one magnetic moment representing all of the spins of that sample. B1 is the field in this coil. And so we have a field B1. I'm going to place it along the x direction. Okay, so nicely perpendicular to that. And so what happens? The magnetic moment oscillates in the xy plane. But let's just take the x piece, right? The x piece has an oscillation. And so there's a time dependence. The time dependence is at omega naught. And so we pick up an EMF across the coil. Yeah? Okay. So I'm going to take these two signals, this one, which is cosine of omega naught t e to the minus t over t2. Right? Just from our map there. And I've assumed that we started off with the spins along the x-axis. And I'll show you how we do that in a moment. But there's a signal. And here we have cosine of omega tt. These little devices are called ring modulators or mixers. So we have the signal coming in. It's split in both of these. It goes to these ring modulators. And what a ring modulator does is it's just a diode. And so it multiplies. It's a nonlinear element. It simply multiplies. So if I take cosine and cosine and I multiply them together, then you know that we'll get a signal at the sum in the difference frequencies. Yep. So I get out of this signals at the sum in difference frequencies. I filter it. This is a filter. We keep the low frequency. And then we take it into an A to D converter. A to D, not B. And so I get a digital word out. We do the same thing here. So this frequency, because I've had a signal that was at omega naught and another signal at omega t, then I'll get signals at the sum in difference, but I'm going to keep the signal at omega naught minus omega t. Just keep that part of the signal. I need to do one more thing to you, for you. On this side, I'm going to split the signal so the two outgoing signals are separated by 90 degrees. So one's a sine and one's a cosine. On this side, I'm going to split the signal so that the signals are absolutely in phase. Splitting with a 90 degree phase shifter is really easy, right? All it says is I put an extra piece of cable in there. So it takes a little bit longer for one arm. So that's easy. And of course, if I have sine and cosine on these two arms. Then on one arm, I'll get sine, and on the other arm, I'll get cosine of the difference in frequency. So experimentally, when we detect a signal, we're detecting a signal in a reference frame that is shifted from the original by omega t. So experimentally, I'm not detecting the signal in the laboratory frame where I would have to integrate over 100 megahertz or digitize. But this difference, delta omega equals omega naught minus omega t, this thing is small. It's of order 1,000 hertz. So it's very easy to work with. And we can do that because this frequency here is given by the magnetic field and geomagnetic ratio. And both of these we know very well. And so the variations in this frequency are only going to be on the order of parts per million. So then, if I want to digitize a signal, and I know that it's 100 megahertz plus or minus 1,000 hertz, I don't need to sample it at a rate of capturing it at 100 megahertz. Because I'm only asking a question of, in this small window, what is the frequency? I'm not asking the question of, over this big space, from 0 to 100 megahertz, what the frequency is. I have this promise that I know it's within this small window. Okay? So, experimentally, we detect here in a rotating frame. So in the laboratory frame, the frame that we walk around in, we have the spins that are at thermal equilibrium along the z-axis. And now I'm just going to draw the magnetization. Again, so we're just looking at the ensemble average over all the spins. And we have physically a coil along the x-axis that generates a field. And we're going to go into a rotating frame. We're going to rotate about the z-axis. So the z-axis is going to be common for these two. And so we'll still have the equilibrium magnetization along z. And I'll indicate those two by primes. We have the time evolution of the density matrix and if I get my notes I'll make fewer mistakes with the signs. So we have the time evolution of the density matrix just given by the Liouville von Neumann equation. And We want to rotate to get into this rotating frame. So we know that if the magnetization had been in the x-axis at some time, then it would rotate and it would rotate by omega naught. Okay? That's the precession term. Here, I'm going to choose to rotate this reference frame by a unitary that's e to the minus I omega t over 2 sigma z. So the spin is rotating by omega naught, and I'm going to rotate the reference frame. Depends on, be careful how many times I lose signs. If I rotate about this, then in this frame, I should see the spin still rotating, but that rotating at a frequency of delta omega. And you might think, well, why don't they just put delta omega to zero and be done with it? But remember that we said that omega naught could vary by 1,000 hertz. And so I don't want to use that to define the reference frame. And up here, omega t has a special meaning. I set the synthesizer to that value. So I've chosen that experimentally by dialing up some knots. And so we're going to keep that. So we'll have u is equal to e to the I omega t over 2 sigma z. I bet I forgot the t over here. So the system is going to rotate. And, okay. I have a negative sign in my notes. I'm going to leave it there for now. But I bet you in the end, it should have been a positive sign. We'll look at that. If I have a unitary, I can define a Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian for this rotation is equal to minus omega t over 2 times sigma z. Yeah? Okay, so we have a Hamiltonian. Now the density matrix, we can define in this reference frame. So this is a unitary. That takes us into the rotating frame. Okay, so that's how we get there. And so I can define rho tilde as being the density matrix in that frame. As just the evolution of the density matrix rotated as it should be. And of course, this is time dependent and these are time dependent. So then we can ask, well, what is the time evolution of rho tilde? So this is equal to so nothing interesting here. But that's okay, because I know what the derivative of u is, because we've written up u before. So the derivative of u is going to be I times the Hamiltonian times u. And here, the derivative of u bar will be minus I times the Hamiltonian times u inverse. And of course, we already know the Liouville von Neumann equation. So the time evolution here is minus I, the commutator of the Hamiltonian and the density matrix. Yeah. So we can put it all together. So d rho tilde dt is equal to I h sub r u rho u inverse. Okay, from here, and then this term says it's equal to u, the transformed commutator, plus it's equal to, and I'm going to swap the order of the Hamiltonian and its operator, but it's its operator, so they commute, and so life is good. And so I can do that. I haven't made any egregious errors yet. Here, we can rewrite the operator in the interaction frame. Here, we can rewrite the commutator in the interaction frame. And now I need to define for you, so I've just done it. Yeah? Oh, yeah. Right, so absolutely, should be there. That's why I give you the printed out notes. I pretend that they're more correct. And so we've written everything in terms of the interaction frame. And now we have this nice compact representation that says, oh yes, the time rate of change in the interaction frame is minus I the Hamiltonian in the interaction frame. Okay. And then we get plus I H R rho tilde minus rho tilde H sub R. And so now I can pull that in. And I made you a promise that I had made a mistake of I here. And I want that to be negative. So take all your notes and change that to plus and that to plus and propagate it. Okay? And then with that bit of magic, add this negative sign, we get minus I H minus H sub R, H tilde, rho tilde. And so now we see how the system evolves. It evolves under this so-called effective field here. Which is the difference of the original Hamiltonian in the interaction frame minus the Hamiltonian that took you to the interaction frame. So d rho tilde dt is equal to minus I h effective rho tilde. And in this particular case, h was equal to omega naught sigma z over 2 HR was equal to omega t over 2 sigma z. H tilde, of course, is equal to the same thing in this particular case, because the unitaries that are taking us into the interaction frame are rotations about z, and so they, of course, commute with this Hamiltonian. And so we see that H effective is equal to an H naught minus HT over 2 sigma z. And so now then we have a nice compact representation that shows us exactly what we wanted to see here, that as we move into the interaction frame, then in the interaction frame, the spin's going to rotate slower. It'll rotate by the difference of the frequency of the Zeeman interaction and the frame that we set. And we set it by a knob on the synthesizer. So that's this physical frame that we're in, this rotating frame. And of course, it's obvious that in the interaction frame, the effective field that the spin sees is smaller, right? That as I move into the interaction frame, there's still a Zeeman interaction, but the Zeeman interaction is reduced by the amount of the how fast I'm going into the registering frames. Yeah, you have a question?
I see that to get rho tilde, rho tilde is u rho u inverse.
Yeah. That's just a question of that negative sign, right? Right. So you have to, and I'm sure I'll get this balled up. Here, we've got the spins rotating in one direction, right? And now I want to effectively remove part of that interaction, right? And so, if you said, oh, I'm rotating the reference frame, then it sounds like it should be positive. If I'm rotating the spins, of course, it's negative. Yeah? Yes? Yeah? So, there it is. It's always a drag to pay attention to signs on the board. So I'll leave it to you, okay? So now that we have the system in an interaction frame, in the interaction frame, tells us that the Zeeman interaction is reduced. This isn't the most interesting piece of it. I want to go and look at what happens when I apply this RF pulse. So in this diagram here, we're going to apply a magnetic field through this coil that's resonant with the spin system. Okay, so here I have an oscillating current. I'm applying an oscillating current to this coil. And so I'm going to create a field, B1, that is some amplitude, cosine of omega t along the x direction. And B1 is much, much smaller than B0, 10 to minus 4. And we want us to see how this can have an influence. And the way it has an influence is this the right one? It's not shown there. The way it has an influence is by being in resonance. I want you to think about this as though you've got your knees or something on a swing and you're pushing them. And you want to push them in phase. You have a question?
Yeah, so what are you describing there with the B1 expression? Because I would think that like it should be a vector field, but it looks like it's an operator.
So here I'm saying that we have a coil. The coil's along the x-axis, so it's creating a field along the x-axis. And that the effective Hamiltonian of that varies in amplitude over time. Yeah? Thanks. Yeah, it's called the Hamiltonian of the RF. So the way this is going to work is just as though you're pushing this swing. And so what I've plotted here, if you can see that little vector along the z-axis, is the effective field, so the combination of the Zeeman field and this B1 field. So that's the time-dependent Hamiltonian. And of course, as a time-dependent Hamiltonian, the part along z is going to stay there, and the part along x is going to oscillate. And it's just going to oscillate back and forth. But because it always oscillates exactly in phase with the spin precession, then the blue curve is the evolution of the spins as a function of time. And you can see that we can therefore rotate the spins away from z and, in fact, to anywhere on the Bloch sphere just by having that little bit of evolution. Now, it won't surprise you that if I do this off resonance, then I can't get everywhere. And if you look at this as I rotate the coordinate system, you see that we cover only a little bit of the Bloch sphere. And here, of course, what's happening is you're pushing out of sync with that. So now let's take and add that term. So I'm going to take the Hamiltonian now as being still omega naught over 2 sigma z plus cosine of omega t over t times t sigma x. And I'll put some amplitude here, which I'll call omega 1 over 2. And omega 1 is the amplitude of the B1 field times the gyromagnetic ratio. All right, so there's our Hamiltonian now. And this is the field that we want to see driving the spins. Now we can go through and say, as we talked about before, that this oscillating field I can break into a sum of a rotating and counter-rotating field. So I can take and replace this with e to the I omega t over 2 sigma z sigma x and we'll keep the frequency in front of that. Okay, so now I have two fields. They're rotating in opposite directions. And so when they're aligned along the x-axis, they constructively add. when they're aligned along the z-axis, they destructively add. And so we correctly describe this piece. And now we go into the reference frame that we want. And to make things simple for a second, let's just take these two to be equal, just to save us a little bit of algebra on the board. And then H tilde is still going to have this term. Oops. And then we're applying this U of e to the minus. So then when I apply U here, so I get the term that is U e to the I omega t t over 2 sigma z, and I'm going to have the rest of it in U inverse here. You see that the two operators cancel, and so we get the term here that is omega 1 over 2 sigma x. And I'm sorry, but there's a factor of 2 there, right? Because it's rotating and counter-rotating two of them. And so we get one term, and it comes in as a factor of 4 reduced. And then the second term comes in rotating in the other direction twice as fast. And you had a question. So here, this part is still rotating. This part, the counter-rotating field stays. The rotating field becomes static in the rotating frame. And of course, the Zeeman piece continues in this interaction frame Hamiltonian, but the effective Hamiltonian, this drops out. And so the effective Hamiltonian has only this term plus the counter-rotating term. And so far, no approximations, right? So everything's good. Just says, in this interaction frame where we want to see this dynamics. Now, we have to worry about this counter-rotating frame field. And this counter-rotating frame, you know, if you're here pushing your niece on a swing at the right frequency, you know, this is like she has a vibrating iPhone in her pocket, right? It's acting at some frequency that's much, much too fast to influence any of the dynamics of the spin. And okay. Experimentally, numerically, I show that here. So I calculate this for you. And we start off with the vector along z. And in this case, I make the B1 field really, really big. And you can see the motion of that vector. Okay, maybe you can't see the motion of that vector. But that vector makes a little bit of a wobble right along the z-axis. But it has such a small angle that it's of no consequence. And let's just look for a second. If I said that I have a Hamiltonian that's cosine of omega t sigma x, And I ask you, calculate the evolution for that. Well, you would say, oh, well, this thing commutes with itself at all times. So when I look at the system, I can describe an average Hamiltonian. So if I take u to be e to the I integral of h of t dt 0 to t, right? Then I could say, oh, well, this is not so bad. Here, I can replace all this with some average Hamiltonian. And if the system commutes with itself, then it's the average is just the average. And so that we see, on average, the evolution is zero. Now, of course, for very short times, there might be a little bit of evolution. But those very short times are short with 1 over that frequency. Yeah? Yes. Yep. Because if I have a cosine and I average over half a period, it's not zero. Right? So we see small deviations. Now, if I add that term, then we've got to take a step back and say, well, hold on. Now, I shouldn't be so cavalier about just integrating this, because this doesn't commute with itself at all times. And so now, as I integrate the dynamics of that, I need to be careful of the non-commutivity of this. And so I want to integrate, sure, the zeroth order term will be the integration of this. The first order term, the correction term, will be the integration of the commutator. And then we'll integrate nested commutators. And you've seen that, you've seen hints of that in the Baker's-Campbell-Hausdorff equation. Yes? I get a few people saying yes. A few more. Take this term as a problem set, and show me that it goes to zero, just like this term does. Okay? That even though you have to look at the correction terms, that still the average Hamiltonian will go to zero. Okay. Now here, so what we're going to do is we're going to drop this. And this is called the rotating wave approximation. And now, of course, it really is an approximation. But it's a very robust approximation. Even when these frequencies are somewhat close, this is still a good approximation. And if you're getting your notes right, there's a factor of omega 1 over 4 there. Again, it's in the notes. All right. Now, in writing down that rotating wave approximation, we made the assumption that omega naught was equal to omega t. But now that we throw away the counter-rotating frame, rotating field, we can write down h effective in the general case. So in the general case, h effective is going to be delta omega over 2 sigma z plus omega 1 over 4 sigma x. And so if we're looking at the evolution of the system, so these should be primed, but I won't again put the primes there. We're always looking at the rotating frame. If we look at the field, well, then we have a field which is delta omega along the z-axis. Omega 1 over 2 along the x-axis. And so here is our effective field. And if we have spins along z, then of course they will simply precess about that. And this picture I showed you This picture I showed you of the laboratory frame just says that this set of trajectories is what it looks like when I'm precessing, when I'm nutating in a cone, and then I add a rotation about z. Okay? All right. So that takes us to everything we need to know to describe the sets of experiments that we would use to characterize a spin system. And so I want to take and do that, I think, tomorrow, so that we have the full time to do it. The rotating wave approximation, you should have a look at this average Hamiltonian. You should think about that picture. It's a very useful picture. And here, for all of my blathering about the sign is correct in the notes. Okay? So sorry about blathering, but there it is correctly given. Any questions? Yeah.
Can you explain again about our
Yes. And actually, I do want to take two more minutes. There was one more thing I want to say. Here, this just says, for convenience, so that I don't have to rewrite this in terms of omega naught, I've just taken that assumption. It says, in this picture, delta omega would be equal to zero, and we'd be exactly in the xy plane, right? And so it allows me to drop that piece, okay? Now here, we've seen these dynamics, and this allowed Bloch to write down his famous equations, which we're going to start with next class. But again, go back just to the end of World War II. So Goiter has said, this is how you measure NMR. He also said something really important. He said, there's no point in trying. Because at that point, they didn't know anything about relaxation. And so they assumed that relaxation was spontaneous. And so if I say I have a dipole, and the dipole is at a frequency of megahertz, and I want spontaneous emission to the field, you know the rate of dipolar emission goes as the frequency cubed. And megahertz is really small. And so you put in the numbers, and you get the age of the universe. So when Goethe did the experiment, he wasn't so surprised to not see a result, because he thought that once you put the spin systems in the magnetic field, they would never actually polarize. Okay? Bloch and Purcell, from playing around at MIT as young before postdocs, before they had a faculty position, they go back to Harvard and Stanford. And Purcell, you might know of, he's famous in electricity and magnetism, a great spectroscopist, normally thought of as the guy who teaches classical E&M. And Bloch, you better know, because the Bloch waveform comes from him. Okay, so Bloch is known for developing quantum mechanics. And they published their papers, And Bloch says, well, Purcell publishes a beautiful description, just like I've shown you there, probably with less errors. And Bloch publishes a classical picture. The guy who does the classical stuff publishes quantum. The guy who does the quantum stuff publishes classical. And Bloch says, ah, I can prove to you that there's an isomorphism between a spin one-half particle and a vector in ordinary space. And so he just publishes his equations as a set of equations showing the classical dynamics of a magnetic moment. And Bloch certainly was the one who later on describes relaxation in a purely quantum mechanical way perfectly. So, you know, this is his way of getting insight, that you don't need the quantum mechanics to look at one spin, one-half particle. And so here you have precession, and then here I have the effect of the radio frequency pulse, and then I have relaxation. And then we have to add to this a term that gets us back to equilibrium. So this says we're precessing. So that's the Zeeman interaction. This is the RF field. This is relaxation. And this takes you back to equilibrium. And for any spin one-half particle, regardless of how you compose it out of superconducting circuits, you compose it out of charge fluctuations in a dot, it always is going to look like this. Okay? And so we'll come back, start from that next class, and see what we can do with it.